Good morning. We're opening up for the Senate. We're here today to have an informational hearing and on Oregon's custody law. And our presenters today is Joseph Cowles and Dr. Carl Peterson. Gentlemen, thank you all very much. And we will probably have a couple other members that will be joining us when they get here. It's kind of like when we kind of get off of our regular schedule, people start positioning themselves for other things in their calendar. So I know that hopefully they will be able to come in and participate. But however you'd like to start off, if you just need to put your name on the record, and we're here to.
Okay, great. Thank you. My name is Joseph Cowles, and I'm here to discuss state custody laws, current state custody laws, and I have with me Dr. Peterson.
Dr. Carl Peterson. I'm a licensed psychologist in Eugene, Oregon.
So I had put together a handout for you to kind of go through and steward the process, if that works for you. And thank you again for giving us the time today. And Senator Przanski, you're aware of what I'm hoping to cover today and the passion behind it. And so I thank you very much for giving me the time.
You bet. Our pleasure.
So I'll start with the overview. And, you know, the first bullet point is Calvin's story, but it's really children in general. I have one child. His name is Calvin, and that's the only experience that I can really go off my experience. So in lieu of Calvin's story, it's really children in the state of Oregon. Then we'll go over the current state custody laws, where we find the judge's limitations are to have the appropriate arrows in their quiver to make the best decisions in the best interest and welfare of our children in the state of Oregon. The adverse effects of current state law with the children in the state of Oregon, past research I want to cover briefly, the Oregon Task Force back in, I believe, 2010 and 11, what their findings were, dispute those a little bit. And then opportunities for improvement, current state law and opportunities moving forward. And the prospective results of these improvements are arrows in the quiver of the judges to have the power to make the best decisions in the interest and wellness or welfare of our children. And then lastly, I'd like to open the floor for questions and possible next steps. So my son's story, he's 9 years old, and I've been separated for 8 years. My son for many years has wanted to have a voice, and he's been using his voice, but it's just not really heard from the legal system. And my goal today is to discuss possible opportunities to allow children to have a voice in growth. Children evolve from birth to the time they're adults, and our laws are not evolving with them or the parenting plans. Once it's set, very often, especially with custody, that stays throughout the childhood of the child, regardless of how the child feels. And I think there are some solutions to help from a legal perspective evolve with the child through their growth. In my experience, I went through a lot of court-appointed mediation as well as private mediation, trying to find resolution to be involved in my child's life and have decision-making power, at least being involved in the decisions regarding my child. And I've felt strongly legally disenfranchised from the process of parenthood and being involved in my child's life like I want to be and like he wants me to be. Mediation was, there was really no resolution. There was a lot of communication, and but that's it. It just stopped there. After the court mediator had actually, in a way, excused us the second time around because there was no resolution, and we tried private mediation, and that didn't work either. So at that time, when the county had, in a way, dismissed us, saying that we needed to be willing to reach resolution or not come back to mediation. And at that time, custody evaluation was ordered from the other parent and went through that process. And the custody evaluator faces the same challenges that judges do. It's really a sum-zero game. It's or zero-sum game, rather. It's all or nothing. And with as far as custody is concerned and the decision-making regarding the child, through these experiences, I've just had the opportunity to learn current state law and where it's conflicting and where there might be opportunities for improvement. So the next page is just my son had put together this. He had an art project at school, and it was to write something he was thankful for. And he told me the reason he wrote this is so people around him, including teachers and his principal, would know how much he loves me and how much he wants me involved in his life. And he wants me to be involved in every aspect of his life. And we've had our challenges thus far. And so this was his way of speaking, because he doesn't really have a voice other than this. The current state custody laws state that the court shall give primary consideration to the best interests and welfare of the child, and no preference in custody shall be given to the mother for the sole purpose she is the mother, or the father for the sole purpose he is the father. I think in early childhood, I don't necessarily want this to be the focus, but in early childhood, I think there is more nurturing that does take place. It might make sense for the mother to be more involved, have more parenting time. But as the child gets older, things change, the child changes, their needs change. And I think there's a way to change with the child and support them in their changes and growth. The other law that I wanted to go over is, or statute, is the court shall not order joint custody. This is really the reason I'm here today is hinging on this particular piece right here, that the court shall not order joint custody unless both parents agree to the terms and conditions of the order. So essentially, that is creating the zero-sum game. It's as far as custody is concerned, if one of the two parents, all it takes is one of the two parents saying, I don't agree. I want to be the decision maker. And then the judge has to rule in one of the two parents' sole custody. And I think there's a way, I mean, as we all know, separations, divorces, whatever the situation is, very often it can be adversarial. They're not getting along. They're not in love. There might be one that feels abandoned or left. And it's by nature adversarial. And I think by the courts only, or judges only having this option, or in essence, it's Hobson's choice. It's there really is no choice. It's sole custody for this party or this parent or the other, as opposed to, again, I think I need to reiterate that if one of the two parents doesn't agree because they're hurt, for example, then the judge has no choice but to rule sole custody for that or the other parent. And typically, in early childhood, it favors the mother, but that ruling goes all through the childhood, and there's no changes. So I think by judges having the opportunity to rule joint custody, even if both parents don't agree, I'm not saying that joint custody needs to be the presumption, but I think judges need to have the ability to rule joint custody, or at least divide up the tenets of custody, which currently there's, let's see, well, we'll get to that, but there's four tenets of custody, and I'll go over those here shortly, how it's flawed and how it could be improved. judge's limitations, as I mentioned, sole custody for one or the other parent if one of the two parents doesn't agree. And it's a mandate. They're, in essence, handcuffed to if they see possibly a different decision that would be more appropriate and tailor-fit specific parenting plans or custody on a case-by-case basis, they're really not able to. The 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, Section 1, states, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. And I question that this, if this is due process, one of the parents saying that they can't agree on matters and want sole custody, and for that reason, you know, that is currently the due process. And I think that does affect my liberties as a parent. I'm legally disenfranchised from my child for absolutely no other reason than the mother saying that she wants sole custody. And as a parent, I feel that's taking away my right as a parent and my liberty. The adverse effects: our children don't currently have a voice. They can't talk to, for example, a guardian ad litem, somebody that can hear how they feel and what their needs are. It's really, it's concrete once the decision is made from a custody standpoint. Excuse the balance of both parents' involvement in the child's development and upbringing. I think that's the reason why we see some deadbeat parents, is because they feel alienated from their child due to not having any sort of legal authority or decision-making power, in essence feeling helpless. And also, the court has no record of the child. The child could be going through a very difficult childhood, but there's no record of that because there's no one for the child to talk to. And sure, they can talk to school counselors and therapists, but when it's all said and done, that's working through the issues, possibly from a mental health standpoint, but from a legal standpoint, it's not helping the issue. And that's what we need to focus on. The parents, as I mentioned, one of the two parents is essentially legally disenfranchised from all decision-making authority with their child or children. This also increases litigation when it's a zero-sum game. Typically, it's adding to the adversary. One parent is wanting sole custody, therefore the other parent needs to ask for sole custody, or they can't be granted the sole custody. And they're starting at polar opposite extremes rather than trying to work together. And I think if, you know, people in the state of Oregon, residents in the state of Oregon, knew that there was a possibility for a judge to rule joint custody regardless of what they say about not getting along, I need to make the decisions, we can't agree, that to me is not due process. So it's all or nothing, or it's a zero-sum game. Increases the percentage of absentee parents, as I mentioned, and then the monetary loss from the parent standpoint of trying to do the right thing for their child. I've been listening to my child since he was a little boy and could communicate verbally, and his message has been constant the whole way through. And there's, you know, I've tried everything I can to try to help him and support him, and for that reason, I've pretty much, you know, lost everything monetarily. But that's not, you know, that's so secondary to wanting to do the right thing for my child, and I wouldn't change anything for that reason. For the judges, they don't have the right arrows in their quiver. I shouldn't say the right arrows. They don't have enough arrows in their quiver. They have one choice, and it's Hobson's choice. It's really not a choice at all. And I hope that you folks can see that. The inability to tailor-fit the custody plans on a case-by-case basis. Again, if both parents agree on joint custody, it's pretty easy. But it's also very broad. And I think there's even ways that judges could tailor-fit custody on a case-by-case basis with the information they have at hand much better than they currently do, which is all or nothing. Past research, Oregon Task Force, the large basis of their findings were based on some data from a 20-year longitudinal study, case study done by Jennifer McIntosh from the Australian Government Attorney General's Department. the article or the study was post-separation parenting arrangements. And a large basis and part of the findings of this Oregon task force were based off Dr. Jennifer McIntosh's findings. And the flaws that I find in this is, you know, it's a 20-year longitudinal study. That makes sense. But, you know, cultures change and we evolve as human beings. And I can't believe that we are still where we were 20 years ago. I think women are more involved in the workforce. I think men are staying at home more. And we talk about equality all the time. But when we're but in this particular scenario, the equality just isn't there. The sample groups are taken from another culture. It's a legal, it's a different legal system. It's just, it's comparing apples to oranges from my point of view. Opportunities for improvement. This is the focus here for me. I think this is really possible solutions that I just wanted to go through with you and hope that you agree. One size does not fit all. The alternative solutions are the judges having the opportunity and the power to rule joint custody and possibly appoint a guardian ad litem. And I don't know if guardian ad litem is the correct term. From my understanding, guardian ad litems have a broad sense or more broad control than maybe what I had in mind. Dr. Peterson, would you like to elaborate on that at all?
I can do that at some point.
Okay. So privately or assigned through the courts, and essentially what I was wanting to indicate, possibly instead of a guardian ad litem, is just a third party for the child to communicate with and who could possibly make decisions on parenting time. If one parent wants to go for a month out of country on an adventure and the other parent is saying no just because they don't want the child to have that experience, I think there is a benefit of having a third party that could take the information at hand and say, well, this is a good experience for the child, because it's not about the other parent and their experience. The focus is on the child. The child's needs will evolve and change through childhood. And also having record of the child, I think there would be less child abuse cases if there was an opportunity for a child to be heard from a legal standpoint, as well as from possibly a school counselor or a teacher. So I don't know if option is the right word, but it would be joint custody and appointing somebody, a third party, to be involved in the child's upbringing. And again, that could be somebody that both parents agree to, grandmother, their therapist, or possibly an arbitrator, a mediator, whoever they find appropriate, or the courts could assign somebody. And then the second option, which I find very interesting, and I don't think has been considered before, but I think it's a very, very good solution, and that is dividing up the tenets of custody. If the parents truly can't agree on matters, well, then possibly the judges would have the opportunity, if they don't feel that they can put it in the parents' hands, it's too volatile, for example, they could divide up the tenets of custody. If father is a educator and mother is in healthcare, well, then maybe mother would be the appropriate person to make the healthcare decisions, and father would be the appropriate person to make the decisions on education. By dividing up these tenets of custody, that would give judges that opportunity. The fourth tenet of custody is living, and that is divided up, and I'm still unclear as to why judges in the courts can divide up the physical parenting time, which is very critical and the most critical piece, but not able to possibly divide up the other tenets of custody, the healthcare, religion, and education. The perspective of results of judges being able to rule joint custody regardless of the parents agreeing or not. And again, I think that's not enough for one parent to say they can't agree and therefore it's sole custody. I don't believe that's due process. Child has both parents' continued involvement. custody structures can evolve with the child. That's critical. Neither parent is legally disenfranchised from their child without due process. Preserves resembles more of a family dynamic, less adversary between the parents, knowing the courts can rule joint custody. They might not start at opposite ends of the spectrum and rely on tons of litigation to get an end result. And then, of course, parents can preserve the monetary resources for the child's development and future. And from a judge's standpoint, this is very beneficial because it gives them the power needed to rule in the best interests and welfare of the child or children, which is what our state law indicates that we will be doing. So I think that's very conflicting. Next, I have questions and next steps, but if you don't mind, I'd like to give Dr. Peterson an opportunity to speak at this time.
Yeah, we'll do that, and then after both of you have done the presentations, then we'll open up for questions.
Perfect.
Mm-hmm. I think you could feel in your hearts from Joseph's expressions. He brings the pain and suffering as a parent to this talk.
Dr. Peterson, just for the record, I need you to put your name on the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's Dr. Carl Peterson. I'm a licensed psychologist in Eugene, Oregon.
Okay, thank you.
And I just indicated that Joseph here, I think, brought the pain and suffering of a legally disenfranchised parent and his experiences with a son who has for years advocated for more time with his father, and Joseph's frustration as well as his son's frustration with a system that does not allow that to happen. From my vantage point, I have a different feeling about all of this, and I hope you'll bear with me. My feeling is frustration and at times anger, and I'll explain to you why I feel that way. I've worked as a licensed psychologist for 38 years, and I have consulted with the Department of Human Services on the topic of attachment, working with all incoming caseworkers for the last 25 years on the issue of attachment, because attachment is at the core of parenting. If you don't have attachment, you are not an effective parent. And I also have worked in my private practice earlier, working with Department of Human Services on termination of parental rights cases. So these are cases with unbelievably abusive or neglectful parents, and working with the state of Oregon to literally remove their right to have any access to their child. And these are horrendous kinds of cases, and of course require significant evidence to warrant removing those rights. I also have done custody evaluations, and in that work, I'm not just thorough on testing the parents for personality defects and things like that, which almost universally show you no evidence that would suggest who would be the rightful parent, and yet that's a major focus of custody evaluations. And the part that I would look at would be attachment, because that is the quintessential part of being an effective parent. And that issue is rarely looked at by custody evaluators, just so you know. The evaluation tools of custody evaluators, psychological testing, none of those tests have ever been validated for the purpose of making decisions about legal custody. So I could literally give each of you an MMPI test and make a decision about whether you should have your children or not, and yet there's no validation for that. And I suspect you would not like your children removed on the basis of something that's invalid. So that's a part of what frustrates me with the system. The other part that frustrates me is when I was doing custody evaluations, I was, of course, involved with parents, and I would meet with both of the parents and interview them and ask some questions. And one of the questions I would ask each parent was, prior to getting involved in this dispute about the end of your marriage, did you ever feel that the other parent was inadequate in some way? And if so, how? And about 80% of the people told me, no, I didn't see them as inadequate. He was a good father or she was a good mother. And, gee, well, okay, the next question is, did you ever have significant difficulties in trying to make decisions about your children, which school they'd go to or religious or, you know, doctors or any of that kind of thing? Well, again, about 80% of them said, no, we didn't have a problem. Yet 100% of those people were in front of me engaged in a custody fight. And I asked them, so how did it come to be that you're petitioning for sole legal custody? And they would tell me, well, I spoke with my attorney, and that is how I can protect my legal rights, is to have sole legal custody. And they didn't need their legal rights protected. They didn't have an issue with their legal rights until they spoke with the attorney. And some of them told me they spoke with a friend who had difficulties with their partner, went for sole legal custody. So 80% of those people would probably, if a judge could rule joint legal custody and do it in a nuanced way, that said, you know, I understand from the custody evaluator that you people were able to negotiate these things prior to going through a divorce. You need to understand a divorce is a very difficult time, and it is very likely that in the future you'll be able to get back to negotiating about your children. So I am going to order joint legal custody because I believe it's in the best interest of your child and the two of you. I believe that option needs to be available. Now, I'm also a person who early in my practice, because of a specialty in child trauma, had referred to me a case, and I'm going to share the name of the case with you because it's on the public record. It's the children of Diane Downs, and I assume some of you know who that is. And so I worked with the surviving two children. She shot each of her three children twice. One was killed pretty much outright. The other bled as she was driving around waiting for them to die, bled out, and essentially suffered a minor stroke. That one I worked with because she survived. The other was paralyzed from the waist down. Now, since that time, because of that case and the notoriety of it, I've actually worked with six surviving kids where a parent attempted to kill them. And I looked at each of those cases, and four of those cases were also cases where legal custody was part of the stress that put the parent over the top to want to do that. That's the tip of the iceberg. And something you should also know is, domestic violence is an issue in our culture, and there's a lot of emphasis on women being battered in domestic violence. And I'm all for the idea of supporting battered women. And for what it's worth to you, about 20% of the people battered are actually men, and I believe in supporting them as well. But a thing that you should know in terms of fatalities is that you are four times more likely to be killed between the ages of 0 and 5 in any year than you are any year in the adult life of a woman. So it's very dangerous to be a kid in our culture. And I think we need to do anything we can to reduce the stresses on parents and anything that contributes to the stress. There are people who literally take the nuclear option around things like this. They are removed from legal custody. They get an opportunity to be around their kid. They kill their kids, they kill their former partner, and they kill themselves. And that's pure and simple because of legal custody. Joseph and I have talked about this a lot, and I really believe, and I'm almost 70 years old, so I'm not advocating for me in this. This is really hard work to do. I've done enough of it. I don't really want to do more of this. It's painful, difficult work. But I would like the people who do this work to be effectively trained and to understand the needs and interests of children and to have the power and authority to make decisions with parents who have been given joint legal custody, to be able to make decisions that are binding that can allow these parents to then continue to move forward. And like Joseph said, it could be a grandparent that the two people agree on. It could be a therapist that the people agree on. But it needs to be someone that has the interests of the child. And no offense to those in the room who are legally trained, I asked Shana at the beginning of this, how much training in child development did you get going through law school? And she said, none. And unfortunately, that's true of judges for the most part, and it's true of the attorneys who represent people in these cases. And yet they are the people who are typically listened to by the courts. So one last thing I want to share, and that's I really don't want more people to be killed in this state, more children to be killed. And I find it appalling when bills that need to be passed are tabled or die. These are really important things, and I really want you to take to heart the importance of what Joseph and I are bringing to you today. His pain is his son. My pain is the frustrations with laws that really actually harm children. And I'd really like you to examine those laws, and I would love to work with anybody who is interested in coming up with a bill that could protect these children. That's what I feel I need to say. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Start off unless someone has.
I'm just trying to take this all in. So the courts are making decisions, but without maybe the child training, although I think in Multnomah County and probably like Lane County where you have judges who specialize in those, would have more of an insight in that. But I don't know. I mean, it seems to me it would be very difficult for a judge to say somebody else take charge of this kind of thing, you know, of a joint custody. I didn't realize that it was one or the other, that there was no, that they couldn't say, you know, work together. And I'm about, you're a little older than you, so I've seen many people go through bitter divorces where, you know, it's nuclear.
Yes.
And again, like you said, in the past they got along. All of a sudden something's terrible, the new girlfriend shows up or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then there's just no give and take. And so how to get that balance out again and get beyond that. And as you said, again, later on, usually people, I mean, I had a sister went through a bitter divorce and I thought she would never be able to get along with her ex-husband. And now they have Christmas dinner together. So, I mean, the kids were grown, but people can't, at that time, they can't see the future, it seems like, and they're in the middle of that.
Exactly.
So how do we get by that?
Exactly. And that's where I feel like a judge with the authority to order joint legal custody can frame that in a way in his presentation of his decision that facilitates moving those two people away from the divorce conflict and into a more constructive and cooperative co-parenting arrangement. And the ruling of sole legal custody does exactly the opposite of that. And a problem with sole legal custody also is, I'm assuming all of you are either married or have been married, and I think it's pretty obvious to most people who pay attention in a marriage that there's usually somebody in the marriage that tends to be a bit more dominant. and sometimes a lot more dominant, right? The other's a bit more submissive. That's just pretty much inevitable as you look at relationships. And I think you can imagine with a power imbalance, if the in the sole custody arrangement, if you hand the power to the already dominant person, well, that just creates an even bigger discrepancy. And if you hand the power to the non-dominant person, that's a little like telling a battered woman, well, you just need to go tell your husband to back off. And what do you think is going to happen to her if you do that? So there really isn't a way to mess with the power dynamic and have it not be problematic.
I wanted to comment real quickly. And so I think by judges having that authority and power to rule joint custody, regardless of the hurt that one of the two parties is feeling, is essential. And the alternative is dividing up the tenets of custody. If they really can't agree on matters, well, then you have the possibility to still rule joint custody and divide up those tenets whereas you see where the judge sees fit. So they could still even tailor fit the parenting plan or the custody to a T on a case-by-case basis, whereas currently they don't have a choice. And Senator Barker, thank you for speaking up. I spoke with Senator Edwards and Nancy Nathanson, and both of them were unaware of this state law. And this is huge. I mean, it's the elephant in the room to anyone who knows about it, but it's just not really being taken a serious look at. And it needs to be an issue that's on the forefront, and it's a big issue that needs to be looked at seriously. And you know, I looked at past bills that had gone to committee, and every one of them was adjourned because they ran out of time. And this is really important.
So let me follow up on a couple of things. And Joseph and I have had an opportunity to talk back in Eugene. He's actually, if I remember correctly, a constituent of Senator Edwards. And and Chris had asked me if we could sit down because of my background. And we have talked, and to me, this is one of those areas that I'm just not sure when we think about what is in the best interest of the child, if what we have framed right now in this state works. So, Joseph, you have in your handouts that 35 states plus the District of Columbia have statutes that explicitly authorize joint custody as a presumption or a strong preference. So, can you, I'm not sure if it'd be Joseph or Dr. Peterson, I'd like to have a little bit more information about that. And then I think for Dr. Peterson, knowing that you've done some research and studies as to the risk a child has from that 0 to 5, I'm wondering if there's been any studies for these states where they do, in fact, have this presumption, at least, of joint custody. Do they have different numbers and sense outcomes? Are the children more safe? Mm. Because, mm-hmm. again, it comes back to that. What is in the best interest of the child?
Sure.
And to me, I will be very frank with you. When we've had these discussions up here in Salem, there are the status quo, and people believe this is the only way to do it. I just keep on finding myself torn because it seems like we are disfranchising people, and it doesn't seem like we're always looking out for what might truly be the best interest of the child. So that's, mm-hmm. those are things I'm dealing with that I would like to have more information so we can have these broader, bigger discussions than what we've had in the past.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And as I mentioned, children evolve as they grow, and it makes sense for possibly, you know, their needs to grow and or to change. And I think by offering a guardian ad litem or a third party that they assign that both parties are comfortable with gives that child the opportunity to have the resources evolve with them.
Yeah, and your question, Senator Prezansky, on a comparison of joint legal custody preference states versus sole legal custody preference states, I'm not aware of any study that's been done on that, but I can try and research that myself. There's data in each state, particularly on child fatalities, and there should be research on neglect abuse, although that That's a bit different because I do believe that the judgment of sole legal custody is a significant stressor for some people. I mean, literally, when some people hear that they are legally disenfranchised from their child, they walk away and disappear. And I'm aware of a number of cases where they go to the state of Texas, which my understanding is doesn't enforce child support. And so they just walk away from the whole thing. Wow. Yeah. And, my presumption is these are not real well-attached parents, but...
Representative Greenwood.
Senator, thank you. This is my first term on judiciary, so I'm used to asking naive questions. I'd like to ask the council a question. Our final exam in the family law area. What does joint custody mean legally?
Well, Chairs and Rep. Greenwood, I will find you joint custody. It means that both of the parents can make important choices for the child, and the court can determine a primary residence for the child between the two parents, and they can, under a joint custody agreement, specify who gets which portions of the big issues, such as education, religion, social, those sort of things can be determined by the court under a joint custody agreement, but they're not required to be determined. So the parties can come in and say, we are going to have joint custody, we'll figure it out. And the courts may order them to determine where the primary residence is going to be for the child and what the custody time is going to look like, what the parenting plan is going to look like, but they don't have to do that.
That's an option. How the decisions are made is an option.
Mm-hmm. But, for us, when we look at what the statute 107.169, where it says the court shall not order joint custody unless both parents agree to the terms and conditions of that order.
I understand what that. I was just wondering what the consequences of that.
What the focus is. Yeah.
Thank you.
Singer, if I could ask another. Thank you. So I'm thinking, again, that was a surprise to me the law was that way. But a lot of cases go to mediation, and that, of course, people are already kind of agreeing to do that, I think. So that's – and I see those kind of settlements. But thinking back on the – and I was a cop, so I saw a lot of people divorced that I worked with over the years, high percentage there. And sometimes it would be like, she's taking my kids and leaving. It was a huge deal. I mean, a huge issue. Mm-hmm. And another couple I knew, that they – got divorced, they both bought houses in the same neighborhood so the kid could go to school and could stay at either house on and off, and it was, mm-hmm. I mean, while they were pretty bitter at each other, they worked for that child. But I'm concerned about this. That it just makes no sense to say when I'm mad at my wife that I'm going to go like, no, I'm not going to agree to that. Mm-hmm. And that's the end of it. You know, mm-hmm. the judge mm-hmm. has no authority to try to calm that situation down.
Right. Or I'm mad at the person I'm getting a divorce from, and therefore I'm going to make a choice to have them legally disenfranchised from their child.
And of course, I want the battered woman to be protected. Everybody does. I mean, I don't want to put her in harm's way. And I know there's a lot of people, like, when it comes to visitation, you're an hour late picking them up, and so by God, I'm not giving them back, or you didn't do something, so I'm not going to let you take them on your weekend. You have all those kind of things that are
right.
Really,
it's horrible sometimes, isn't it? It's truly
getting the call when you're the cop and you go there, and people are not. You can't reason with them. I mean, they're furious, and
sure,
you trying to say you'll look at this different tomorrow, and they don't care. You know, I don't care if you arrest me. You will tomorrow. I know you don't today, and you try.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Settle it down, but the stresses of somebody the thought of you're going to lose your kids, and then you're and of course we see that even without the kids, where the wife, I'm not going to let you leave. I mean, the abusive husband,
mm-hmm.
that would really compound that with the kids.
Yeah, those are horrible situations where the marital conflict gets acted out through the kids.
Yeah,
and the stress on kids of that is phenomenal. It is clear, and there's a lot of research to support this, that while divorce is a complicated transition for kids, it's the continued conflict that has more factor loading for harm to children. And so anything that can reduce that conflict is for the better. And there's an interesting book, it's called The Righteous Mind, that talks about how we the reason I bring it up is because there are people who observe something and then have a feeling about it. You see somebody being battered and you feel, well, that's wrong. Somebody needs to stop this, right? There are also people who have a feeling and create facts to support the feeling and literally create the facts. So in some of the situations that I'm sure you encountered, you had people that had a feeling, I feel crummy about this guy because he had an affair, and therefore he's a bad parent, and therefore he's, see what I mean by that? And he may be a great parent. He may not be the most honorable in terms of fidelity in a marriage, but he may be a great parent.
Mr. Chair, it's interesting. The statute doesn't exactly say the judge can't order joint custody unless both parties agree to joint custody. It says unless both parents agree to the conditions of the order of joint custody. I think it's slightly different, but not necessarily a trivial difference.
That is interesting. I've talked with a lot of judges about this and have a few of them at my age that are retired and are now friends. And I know of none who have ever ordered joint legal custody against the parents' wishes, ever. So that's curious that it says that. What rule?
That's in 107.169.
It's right here.
Uh-huh.
The second paragraph.
Okay. Yeah, I would imagine that would be hard for a judge to do when a custody evaluator... As a custody evaluator, I became just eternally frustrated with the notion that I was supposed to always recommend sole legal custody to one or the other parent, because it was evident to me that, as I said earlier, about 80% of the people didn't have a problem with making decisions prior to going through the divorce and didn't come up with the idea of sole legal custody themselves in the first place. So with that information, I would go back to the court at times and say, none of the data in my custody evaluation suggests that this should not be a joint legal custody situation. And I'd actually say that to the court, and still, because of the way it's brought to the court, they would rule sole legal custody to one or the other parent.
I mean, the issue is that I could imagine an order being proposed that says we share both items, and one party saying, well, I'm okay with joint custody as long as I have control over X.
Yes. And
I mean that.
And that's where the tenants come in, because then they can collaborate and say, okay, well, this is really important to me, and then they can, and this is very important to you, so let's tailor fit custody to work for our needs as parents and or for the child's needs.
And Joseph had a really good example of that, and that's the divorcing physician, for instance, and teacher, where perhaps you would give medical authority and medical decision-making to the doctor and decisions about education to the teacher.
I do it the other way.
Other questions?
I guess for me, the next thing is I guess next steps, what does that look like? Because I really don't, I've been working at this for almost 3 years now and meeting with a lot of different folks here at the Capitol building, and the reason I came to you requesting this hearing is because I was feeling extremely stagnant. Like, I mean, in fact, when we had met one of the last times, you said, bluntly, been there, done that. And I don't want it to be been there, done that if we can help it and really look into it further and see how we can help judges have the arrows in the quiver necessary to have the power to rule in the best interest and welfare of the child.
And I'd add to that, I wish I'd paid more attention in my history social studies class in high school, and I'm embarrassed to say I didn't. So this notion of how do you create a bill, I spoke with you, Shanna, a little bit about that at the onset, and I'd love, I'm sure Joseph would too, to engage in a process of trying to conceptually craft something that would be palatable and potentially could be passed to accomplish some of these things. And I don't know, you mentioned going through one of the legislators to begin to look at how that bill would be crafted. And is that the best path to get something like that going?
That's one way.
Uh-huh.
I think the other way, and for something like this, you know, this is such an ingrained, let's say, topic, issue that we face, that I think the better way would be with a work group where you actually would get people coming together, mm-hmm. sitting down, and working through this.
Okay.
And this is one of those scenarios that, I mean, as Joseph says, been there, done that.
Uh-huh.
I hear that from practitioners, more on the legal practitioner side, that they've looked at this and that's why they come back to the study and all like that. But it does, I mean, I keep coming back to the point of what is in the best interest of the child. And when you look at the framework that we have, it just seems like that point is not always at the top of the discussions.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it is one of those things that if there are other states that are doing this, mm-hmm. there should be, the ability to research and see what's the dynamics of under those programs in their states and what are the outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, having those frank discussions in a work group can actually hopefully open the doors to give us answers as to whether there is legitimacy to having a different model than we have now.
Mm-hmm.
And it is interesting when we hear, as we sit here and hear each other's, as to our life experiences, you are talking about, unfortunately, two individuals that were in a personal relationship who are now being separated apart for whatever reasons, and their emotions can, in fact, weigh heavily on what they do to protect themselves and or to get at the other person.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, there's a child many times right in the middle of that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the data that you mentioned, Dr. Peterson, is to that's sticking with me today is the high likelihood of injury or death to a child from 0 to 5. Mm-hmm. And I know, I mean, as Representative Barker said, or Chair Barker said, in your life experiences, you see this as a prosecutor. You see what some of the unfortunate outcomes are.
Mm-hmm.
And there are, I mean, there's how many times have we seen on the news where usually a disgruntled father takes out the family,
mm-hmm.
and then himself.
Mm-hmm.
And
several up in the metropolitan area last year.
Yeah, right. And it's more common than I think we want to acknowledge. And to me, what is it that you can do to reconfigure that so there's not those stressors to the point of where they're not thinking for themselves clearly and they see that their whole world has changed and if it can't be and I can't be part of it, then I want to take these extreme actions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They tip, don't they? They tip from the stresses. There's a graph that I have in my practice that I share with people. That's a longitudinal, there are three longitudinal studies that I put on a single graph, and they're studies of marital satisfaction over the lifespan. So they're 30, 40, and 50-year studies of marital satisfaction, And the studies looked at variables like how old you are when you get married, how educated you are, how much money you make, how close to relatives you live, things like that, all of which in my personal experience and in my work experience, all of those contribute or detract from marital satisfaction. And none of them predicted marital satisfaction. And when you add in age of your first child, all of the data comes together, and it's very interesting how it comes together. And if any of you who are parents will recognize this, you start out when you first get married, marriage satisfaction is nice and high. You add an infant to the brew, and it drops. And I love my kids. I got two of them I'm crazy about. But anybody that says it's easy to have an infant in your home is lying, or they've got nannies. And the next stage is when the child becomes a toddler. It's the first stage of willfulness. It's a little kid saying, no. And that puts parents over the top. It's the first bottom out of marital satisfaction. Comes up in the early school years, drops off to an all-time low. You can guess this one, can't you? Teenagers. And then it works its way back up as you're launching kids. So realistically, that is the biggest stress in being a human being, is raising your children. Anybody have questions about that one?
I've noticed this. I mean, there is a third way, I think I remember. And isn't it something like the Oregon Law Commission that could launch a study of this whole component? I noticed we've had some things come back.
The Law Commission is definitely a avenue for this type of discussions.
Depends on how much is on their plate.
Yeah,
it's one of those things that, I mean, for their embarking on that, I would say I'd want something a little bit broader than the Law Commission,
I think so.
Only because they're all lawyers. As a lawyer.
The problem.
And, you know, but I think those are part of the perspective. I think there's more to it to actually have that well-rounded discussion. And I don't know of any projects that the commission that I serve on has ever engaged in other practitioners in their work that they do, because they are really focusing on, you know, the law itself, and I don't know of where they've expanded that type of a discussion to play part of it. And to me, some of this stuff has got to be the longitudinal studies and under the different models and systems.
Right. I would be ill-prepared to attempt to protect the legal rights of a child. I wouldn't know how to do that. That's what lawyers do. And I understand the appointment of lawyers to cases where the legal rights of a child are in jeopardy. But the cases I'm seeing are where the psychological, emotional attachment rights of a child are in jeopardy.
Yeah.
And as Shanna so gracefully shared with me, that's not necessarily the expertise of lawyers.
And their job is to protect their clients. So
yeah,
they get a narrow focus also. But I would think a work group sounds like a good idea. And mm-hmm. You should have some of those people that the lawyers who are in that field, and some of the groups like the groups that are concerned about the battered women, so that are involved in the family law, those kind of things.
Sure.
Everybody can get together. And I think people who actually deal in the business could sit down together and work this out. I mean, come up with hopefully some kind of a solution to give the court more authority, or to not limit the court's authority to do to try to grant joint custody.
Yeah, we've had actually, and we discussed it, and I'm not sure if this is since Joseph and I've met or prior to that, but we do have different sections within the law in the bar, and one of them is the family law section, and they've had this issue, and it is, you know, kind of back and forth, and then they basically come back and say, well, what we got is what we think is best.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's basically lawyers with their perspective, and to me, by broadening it and what Chair Barker's suggesting, I would also suggest, and I think that's going to be something that we can do. I mean, to me, we have to have the discussion.
Mm-hmm.
We may have the same result and the outcome, but until we do that I just think that it's one of those things that it's almost kind of taboo for us to go there, in the sense of some people think, well, you just can't open those doors. I think we do need to open those doors.
Thank you.
Just see what it is that's behind that door. Mm-hmm. And if we have the best model and the best system, so be it. Well, it'll be, you know, validated. If not, then maybe we should be looking at alternatives based on other, in this case, it appears that we should have other programs or states that have taken a different model, and maybe it's a hybrid of something. I'm not sure, but...
Mm-hmm. And as far as the time limit, it takes time down here to get things through. I mean, we have many good bills that it's taken like 3 sessions. At least we're meeting annually now, which shortens that up by a few years, but it's sometimes difficult to get things through the first time.
I'll wait it out.
Yeah, well, it seems like it'd be worth us to work on that. And thank you very much for your testimony today.
I would love to be involved in, you know, moving forward in any way that I can, as I'm sure Dr. Peterson would as well. And I think it is going to be critical to have a diverse group and not have it all be folks with the focus of law.
It doesn't do much good if everybody's agreeing. I mean, if you got a bigger group and they can agree, that's great. But
agreed.
Well, thank you for coming up and giving us this presentation. And what I would say is that we will work through what we're going to – we have multiple things we'll be doing as different work groups for the interims. Mm-hmm. And as I think as Chair Barker said, it's one of those things that it's going to take some time to work on. So as much as we may like to see something – I can tell you it won't be for the next session just because it's the short session, but the next long one would be basically in 17. Mm-hmm. Would probably be our first option, and that should hopefully give us enough time to actually work through and get different people engaged in making some decisions as to what would be the next step.
Mm-hmm.
So with that, thank you very much. I'm going to go ahead and close the Senate Judicial Committee.
The House.
And, gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And, gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.